Good afternoon. It's now 1 o'clock. We're going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 5069, the Oregon Department of Transportation. For the record, I'm Greg Smith, chair of this subcommittee on transportation and economic development. To my right, we have Susie Jordan, our very capable legislative fiscal staff member, and our subcommittee assistant is Kat Bell. To my left is Chair Gilman of the House Policy Committee on Transportation, and Chair Gilman and I were communicating. We really thought it was a good idea to bring the budget and the policy folks together to hear the same information. So, Chair Gilman, I don't know if you have any opening comments you'd like to share with us.
Thank you very much.
So, with that, I'll turn that over to Susie, who I guess will go through some information for us.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I placed in front of your places a copy of the schedule for the next 6 days with the Department of Transportation, just so you have an idea of what it is we'll be doing on each of those days. And so today we are scheduled to look at the agency overview, doing the missions, their strategic direction, goals, organization chart, and begin a discussion on their programs and services. On Tuesday, we'll continue discussion on programs and services if we don't finish everything up, and then talk about major budgetary issues, ODOT accountability, and do a little bit on the high-level budget. And then following that, we'll do priorities, reductions, performance measures to wrap up the end of our public hearing on the Department of Transportation budget. With that, I'd like to introduce Bruce Warner, Director of Oregon Department of Transportation, to start us off.
Welcome.
And Christina Shearer is Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Analyst for the budget.
Now, I would be remiss if tomorrow we don't do a little organization here, because we have Chair Verger, who's the Senate chair, on our committee with us as well. And if there's at any point something we can be doing on the Senate side, you know my office is always open. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I got so excited over taking everybody to Coos Bay, I failed to tell them that you had issued your lovely invitation, but I will tell them at 3 o'clock today.
Perfect.
So
perfect. Perfect. Director Warner, welcome. What I'm going to just share with the committee very quickly is the way the Ways and Means process is working is there's really a three-pronged approach. And right now we're kind of at the 30,000-foot level, if you will, and Director Warner and his staff is going to go through and give us an overview of their program, and then eventually go through their priorities and a 10% reductions list, and then their performance measures. They have 6 days, and the co-chairs have made it very, very clear to the subcommittee chairs that we need to stay on schedule. So what I'm going to do is ask, as we have questions, if you could just write them down, and then when we get to natural breaks, we'll ask the questions, unless, of course, there's a good question that's pertinent right at that time, then obviously feel free to jump right in. But we do have 6 days, and we're going to try and stay on schedule. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It is a pleasure to be here today to talk with you about our programs and our budget, other than diving in right to the numbers and get a basic understanding of where we're going. So I applaud you in the effort to understand that, and hopefully we can help you understand our budget a little bit more and what we're trying to accomplish with the budget that was put into the governor's recommended budget to you. As Ms. Jordan outlined on page one, I think I'm referring to my sheet that looks like this. It's a presentation that will hopefully allow you to move through this quickly. On page one, I'm just restated what Ms. Jordan has outlined, and I will be talking to you about the agency mission, our strategic direction, spend a little bit more time on our goals and outcomes, and then real quickly on the agency organization. Then I'm going to turn over to Mr. Tindall, let him talk to you about all of our programs, basic programs, and then between myself, Doug, and Mike Marsh, we'll go through the rest of the agenda. So that was just to let you know that we are going to follow your outline to the T. skipping to page two or moving on to page two, ODOT's mission, I think I went over this with the House Committee and some of you previously, but I think it's important to note that our mission is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians. And as I said to the other committees, safe is a very important word to us. You'll find that that's a thread that connects most all of our programs, services, and projects. System, I think, is important because it is not just a highway system. It is a multimodal transportation system for Oregon. And clearly, economic opportunity is why we're here. We've been directed by the legislature and the governor to be an economic boost for the state of Oregon and to position us for the future by having a transportation system that's adequate to support our future needs. And then finally, livable communities. We want to make sure, as I mentioned before, when we build projects, they are consistent with the natural and built environment and solve not only the state problem, but also help the cities and communities get where they want to go. So moving on to the next page, page three, again, I just wanted to point out to you that in 1969, the legislature did actually establish the Department of Transportation, and before that time, it was actually a highway department, and with the intent of making it a multimodal organization. And the second bullet there shows you that ODOT's programs relate to highways and bridges. They relate to railways, public transportation services, transportation safety programs, driver and motor vehicle licensing, and motor carrier regulation. I should note what's not shown on this page, what we should have, is also in our budget, is included the Board of Maritime Pilots. We have that in our budget, and so, again, we'll see that when we get to the organizational chart, but they are part of ODOT's budget. Moving on to page four, I think it's important to note when you look at all of our programs, our priorities and reductions, you'll see that our goals for the department come into play also. As I said, our first and number one goal that we have up top is improved safety. And I'll describe a little bit more with that in a bit. Obviously, we want to move people and goods efficiently. So we're talking about not just people movement, but movement of freights and goods and services throughout the state of Oregon. And then, again, the final goal is improving Oregon's livability and economic prosperity. And you'll see as we move through more on those. Skipping to page five, in terms of the values for the department, which we hold highly, again, you'll see right up at top again is safety. We protect the safety of the traveling public, our employees, and the workers who build, operate, and maintain our system. And we believe that we are here to have a customer focus, to learn from and respond to our customers so that we can deliver better quality products and services for Oregonians. And I want to make it clear that our customers include the travelers, they include freight movers, and those who use our services and facilities, like public transit, as an example. Efficiency, like every department in the state, we strive to get the maximum value from the resources that the public has entrusted us, and we take that very, very seriously. And that combines to the next page, which is a next value is accountability. We strive to build trust with our stakeholders, of which you are one of those, by reporting to you what we are doing and then how we are using the resources that are entrusted to us. And I think from the legislative direction, performance measurements and tracking of what we're doing is very, very important. Problem solving, we do want to work with our customers and stakeholders to find efficient, effective, and innovative solutions to our problems. And I would point out here, I'm going to brag a bit, because I think our access management program, I think as many of you know, has been a priority of mine since I've been at the Oregon Department of Transportation. We've gone from a very rule-bound process, it was black and white, you either met the standards or the answer was no, to we revised our rules, we provided training for our employees, and I looked at the last year's records on this and found out that of the permits that were requested by folks for access to our highways, we approved 94% of them, 6% of them were denied, a couple of those have been resolved in appeals. But what was really important to me is we are now doing customer service surveys through the Oregon State University on customer satisfaction. And in some of our regions, people believe we're providing good to excellent service 92% of the time in this area. And some regions are not as high, and they know that. Another really good thing about measuring performance is people do try to improve, and they see that they're not doing as well as they should. Positive workplace, again, the department does want to recognize, and I think does recognize innovation and initiative, and we want to show respect and honor diversity in our department. On the environment side, all the services we provide, the facilities we provide, we try to provide them in ways that not only protect the environment, but also enhance the environment. And we have some great opportunities as part of our bridge program to remedy some of the things we did many years ago that probably weren't the right thing to do with stream beds underneath those bridges and along those areas. So going on to the next page, page 7, let's talk a little bit more about those individual goals, for example, in improving safety. We do have a vision for what we think that means for Oregon. In terms of safety, we think that travelers and freight movers should be confident that the safety of the transportation system is constantly improving. In other words, getting better out there. We also believe that our vision is that safety is at the core of everything we do, from design to operations to maintenance and use of the transportation system. And I think it's our expectation, and it should be yours, that every year the system becomes safer and transportation-related fatalities, injuries, and property loss are reduced throughout Oregon. And I do want to stress that we are doing well in Oregon. We are one of the nation's leaders in terms of transportation safety. I was just looking at the records, and in the last 5 years, with exception of one blip last year, we have had 6 years now less than 500 people killed in the state of Oregon on city and county roads and state highways. But that is still too many, and we want to work at that and bring that down. What's important to note, the last time we hit 5 years at that level was when President Eisenhower was in office. So that'll give you an idea that we are doing well, but I expect that we can do better in the future. Moving on to the next page, I think I've mentioned to you the four E's. I've mentioned three of them here. In terms of safety, the vision, we want to utilize education, engineering, and enforcement, and the one I didn't mention is emergency services providers, along with traffic management, along with intelligent transportation systems, to improve all of the modes of transportation. The other thing that we're doing, if we're doing safety correctly, is that unsafe drivers and vehicles are kept off of the system. And the other thing that we believe is that if our vision is fulfilled, that injuries to ODOT workers and other transportation workers are reduced by careful attention to safety on the job and during our work sites. And this will be a priority for the department over the next 8 years as we move forward with implementation of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. So what does that look like on page 9 in terms of the outcomes? And all of the outcomes I'm going to describe for you will tie back either directly or indirectly to the performance measurements that you're going to have later on in this week as we go through our phase one part of the budget. In terms of outcomes for safety, obviously the biggest ones is reduction of transportation-related accidents and fatalities. We do capture that data, and you will see that. We also want to make sure that the public believes that safety is paramount, and they feel very, very good about the safety on our highway system, and you'll find out that we check with them. We also want to remove dangerous drivers and vehicles from the roads through our DMV or our motor carrier programs. And then finally, reducing injuries to employees and transportation workers is obviously tracked very, very well, because that's how we're going to know how we're doing. And I would point out that our profession is one of the more dangerous ones of public service. We in public safety are usually the ones that have the highest accidents and loss rates, and so we're mindful of that and want to do better. On page 10, continuing on with the vision now for goal 2, where we're talking about moving people and goods efficiently. Clearly, the vision for us is that people and travelers in Oregon are confident about getting where they need to go reliably at a reasonable cost. And that's whether it's on a highway or on a bus or on an inner-city passenger rail. And also, we think that all segments of the society, including seniors, people with disabilities, and low-income folks, have access to transportation services and hopefully also have choices about which mode of transportation they want to utilize. And I think for the economy, the shippers are able to ship their goods by the most cost-effective mode. They're not essentially strapped or stuck with one mode of transportation. We want to have a diverse, a robust system that provides choice for everybody, the individuals as well as those wanting to ship. Also, we want to, of course, may have delays from congestion, construction, weather, and accidents are reduced. Moving on, page 11, goal 2, continue on with the vision. We also believe that if we're doing our jobs here, the transportation infrastructure is maintained and protect it at its most cost-effective state. So this means, in simple terms, we don't allow the asset to degrade to such a point that we essentially have to rebuild it completely. We should be maintaining it just like you would in your house. You'd be putting a roof on your house when it wore out, just like we would be putting a major pavement rehabilitation or surface on a roadway as it starts to wear out. We also want to say have improvements to existing transportations or new facilities are priorities we've implemented to ensure the movement of goods and people. So when we select projects for funding, they should be foremost dealing with the movement of goods and people. So going on to page 12, the vision continued. The other thing that we believe, if we're operating correctly, is that new technology will be employed to improve the efficiency of the system by better managing traffic networks, by providing timely information to folks. And I bet you a number of you have been on our tripcheck.com website to see the condition of the roads over the passes. But also we're looking at identifying and reducing delays from crashes and other causes. Many people are aided on a daily basis by our comminuted or incident response vehicles, where we're out there trying to clear accidents as quickly as possible, because in major urban areas, for every minute you have of a delay due to that accident, you usually have 6 minutes of congestion that occur. So the more quickly you can clear an accident, the better off for the entire system. And then finally, on this one, we want new technology and best practices in the construction and materials to improve the quality of our infrastructure, and also hopefully we can reduce the delays from construction and maintenance activities. We're doing a number of really innovative things at the department. I would call your attention to the I-84 repaving job that was done in the Portland area, where instead of just essentially doing night paving for a couple of weeks, we went out there and actually shut down the facility one weekend each way, so we were able to essentially repave the entire stretch of the roadway with minimal delays. We provided advance information. It worked well. And those are the kind of things we want to do to try to minimize the impact of folks using the roadways. So going on to page 13, how would we measure ourselves and what are the outcomes in this area? Clearly, we want to, again, check with our users to make sure that they believe we're improving on all of the modes. The one that we track on a regular basis is we want to reduce the hours of delay on our system caused, experienced by travelers and good movers by anything, whether it's congestion, accidents, or construction. We also want to improve the efficiency of DMV and motor carrier and other ODOT services from a customer perspective, and we do check customer satisfaction. You'll hear from our program folks on that. And we are a leader, I believe, in the state in the use of e-government and e-commerce so that people can actually access and transact service with ODOT from home on their computer rather than having to drive to an office. We also do it with our truckers, with Trucker Online. And then finally, we want to ensure we want to ensure equality of opportunity to access transportation system. Again, it gets back to the elderly, the disabled, low-income folks. We want to make sure that there are choices there. So continuing on, the other things that we monitor and check is we want to improve choices of travel and shipping. As I said, not just having rail or truck be the only alternative. We need to have an option in both of those. We want to increase access to the transportation system and services, and we want to increase the reliability of intermodal transfers in a seamless system. So in other words, most goods, if you look at where they start to where they actually end up, they usually go from at least through two modes of transportation to get there. Maybe truck is the exception. But if you look at those top three bullets and outcomes, that's the reason our budget has Connect Oregon as part of it. This is where we're trying to get to the seamless transportation system and provide connections between the modes of transportation. And then finally, on this goal, we want to maintain and preserve our facilities and equipment. And when I talk about facilities, I'm talking about everything from a highway maintenance facility to a highway, the bay pavement, to a bridge, making sure that its bridge rating is adequate. On equipment, we look at the public transit bus fleet to make sure that it's in good condition and can serve the needs. So you'll see some measures on those particular areas as you get into our budget. And then our third goal, starting on the next page, in terms of improving Oregon's livability and economic prosperity. Our vision is clear that Oregonians view the transportation as an integral part of the community and the economy. And in many cases around the state, the highway is the main street going right through that town. So in many ways, the community identity is around that main street. We also would see that if we're doing everything properly here, that ODOT works with state, local, citizen, and business leaders to develop transportation solutions that fit the community and the state interest in terms of transportation. I'll use an acronym here, which I'll describe. It's called CS Cubed. If you've not heard that before, it's something we're trying to do in the department, where we're trying to do projects that are context-sensitive and are sustainable solutions. So in other words, we make sure that they're done in the context of the built natural environment, but also we make sure that they're built in a way that they will sustain and again, minimize the impacts on the environment now and in the future. And then finally, we want to have transportation that contributes to desirable urban and rural areas, helps create safe and livable communities, including revitalized urban centers, downtowns, and main streets. I don't know how many of you have been to the little community of Joseph, but I suspect Senator Johnson has, and she's probably flown in there many times. If you look at that main street, that is a program which was done in concert with the community. It is now an asset. That state highway going through the community is an asset to the community, and it's actually part of the identity of that community. Same way with Grants Pass. Same way with, I wish Senator Carter was here, with Martin Luther King Boulevard. And there's a number of those throughout the state where we've worked with the locals to provide enhancements along with our normal work to essentially increase the livability of the communities out there. So continuing on in terms of the vision for livability and economic prosperity on page 16, we also believe that our highways, freight services, passenger services link all parts of the state. I'm talking about urban and rural, big and small, to economic opportunity for all of the regions. And I think that's what we really try to do. Community values are reinforced by transportation alternatives that are compatible with local land use plans. In other words, we don't want to build a project that does not fit in with the community's desires of the future. And usually we can work with them and come up with an acceptable solution that addresses their concerns as well as the concerns of state mobility and safety. We're also working hard in our vision to have the visual quality of scenic byways and other tourist routes enhanced through cooperation with local government and the natural resource agencies. And we're trying to select projects and implement projects that minimize the negative environmental impact. In fact, I think that if you look at many of our projects, you'll find out that the environment has been improved when we're done. And then finally, I think on this page is that ODOT provides projects that create new jobs or retain existing jobs in Oregon. Our job is in our projects, the workers who provide the design and construct the projects. It's also our projects try to provide access to jobs areas. The industrial lands, as an example, was a priority last session, continues to be this session. And we also have, for example, our immediate opportunity funds, where we try to have monies available to quickly deal with job and bird in hand type opportunities around the state of Oregon.
Really quick, Director Warner. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking at your performance measures about jobs, it was very difficult for me to completely understand. I know that one of your goals is to create new jobs. And then I look at your chart. So am I to assume that I'm to add all of these figures for OTIA 1 and 2 that are on your chart, and that's the number of jobs that the department has already created?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, excuse me. Let's pull the measure up here and take a look at it real quickly. You're talking about in the budget book.
It's page 7 in the performance measures that goes with your page 16.
There we go. Why don't you restate where we are?
So sure. If the members want to look, I guess the first question, Mr. Chair, is you want to go ahead into the performance measures and we'll...
Why don't we address this one?
Okay. So if we look at towards the end of your binders on page 7 after the tab that says Appendix Agency Performance Measures, are all there. This is the one that is on jobs, and the question, Senator, was relating to whether you add them up in order to...
Where you have total number of jobs by program, can I assume by looking at that chart that you have created this number of jobs through OTIA 1 and 2?
And the STIP, Mr. Chair, and Senator
STIP.
Berger.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. All right.
Any other questions?
Moving on, I think I'm still on page 16. Actually, I'm not. I'm going to move on to page 17. Excuse me. The other thing that we look at is one of the measures that concerns the state is the number of economically distressed communities. We believe that through a good selection of projects, we actually help, again, by providing jobs in those communities. And it is always part of our consideration as we move forward on a project. And you'll see some measures related to that. Also, we want to increase business opportunities in economically distressed communities as a result of transportation improvements. And I think some of the improvements we've made in allocation of funds to, for example, the Port of Coos Bay dealing with rail and highway projects is a good example. Treasure Valley biorefinery, we're looking at putting some of the OTIA $3 in the OTIA in the Ontario area. And again, various industrial areas throughout the state, we're making strategic investments to support those areas so that they can provide jobs for Oregonians. And then on the final one on this page is increase the number of cities and communities that have a variety of coordinated transportation options. And you're probably not aware, but we work very closely with the Department of Human Services and others to actually have set up clearinghouses where people can call a single number to dispatch either Medicare or Medicaid type of transit trips along with some of the normal public transit or senior service services throughout the state. And it's been very, very popular. I'd love to see that done in other areas. So that's one of the things that we're measuring because we'd like to have more communities have those options.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to hear you say that you're interested in replicating that. One of the things I don't know if you're tracking right now is both the timeliness of the response and the cost savings. It's been my observation in watching some of these programs that how the rides are distributed, how they're paid for, whether or not rides could be coupled if there was a single dispatch. If you're gathering that kind of data, it might be very useful in helping the legislature maybe give ODOT some additional capacity to have providers consider the ride delivery centers that you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, thanks for the comment. I don't have at my fingertips those, but when we get into the transit side of the organization, I can give you some feedback of where we are and looking at the cost effectiveness of those centers, but my gut tells me they're very cost effective.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I share that feeling, and I didn't expect you to have the numbers right here. We can wait till we hit it in the transit presentation, but it's something that I think we seriously ought to look at, and particularly working with DHS to make sure that the reimbursement patterns make sense, where we're paying multiple members of the same family to drive at great distance for medical appointments that could be clustered, and you only pay once, those sorts of things.
Right.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Moving on now, I'm on page 18. Some of the other outcomes and things that we measure in terms of how we're dealing with livability and economic prosperity is clearly we do track travel times and delays between communities and key areas, key freight corridors, because we know that's important for the movement of goods and services, and time is money for those trucks that are out there sitting in traffic. We also are looking at enhanced scenic qualities of byways and tourist routes. That's subjective, but we do monitor that. And then clearly all of our plans, we need to go through the federal government to assure air quality conformity, and we work very closely with our water resource agencies here at the state and federal level. So I thought it was important, again, to kind of transition to the next part of the presentation, but to really talk about how our services are delivered. I think most of you know that all of our construction work, with the exception of some very minor improvements around intersections and so on that can be done with our maintenance crews, is done through the private sector, mm-hmm. every bit of that work. And ODOT now outsources the majority of the design work. And this is new as a result of the OTIA 3 program. And I think, Representative Richardson, you had a question about that. We have made great strides to do that. And this is a change for us. But, again, the intent and guidance from the legislature was to get this money out to the private sector to create private sector jobs rather than increasing the size of the department. The other things that we do is we provide grants and direct funding for other programs and other state agencies, cities, counties, and transportation people and individuals, in fact, to provide transportation. And I think you're also very aware, but we need to, I think, stress this, is we are geographically located throughout the state of Oregon. If you look at it, we have 5 highway regions, 3 of them here on the west side of the mountains and 2 of them on the east side. We have 98 maintenance stations, which are strategically located to make sure that we can keep the roadways maintained, and especially during the winter, free from ice and snow and are sanded and de-iced properly. We have 6 ports of entry, which is the main entries for trucks coming into the state, where we check credentials, make sure that they have the required information to allow them to go into Oregon. And we have 81 fixed way stations, and you see those up and down I-5 as you're going down, where we check for weight, but also do random vehicle inspections to make sure the trucks are safe. And then we have 64 field offices for Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division, and those are located throughout the state.
Really quick, Director Warner, mm-hmm. Can you flag the 81 fixed way stations?
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to that part in your presentation, can you share with us how you come up with the definition of random, especially as it relates to rural and agricultural issues in the future? We'll
okay.
talk about it.
And then I guess the final thing is that on this page is I did want to stress that we are looking for ways to utilize the Internet and technology more for the benefit of our customers. And I did mention DMV and our Motor Carrier Transportation Division. That B should be a D at the very end there. But those are 2 areas where we're really piloting some good work to ease the burden for our customers. In the next page, I think, you know that we deal with a number of stakeholder and target groups out there. Clearly, the people of the state of Oregon are always involved in our projects and our programs, especially when we start talking about a project in their particular area. Highway users are a big one. Cities and counties are a major partner and player with us. And I think Representative Gilman knows that we want to partner with them more and more, because I think the citizens of Oregon don't care who owns and operates the roadway. They just want to know when they call something is taken care of. So we're looking at ways to provide joint facilities throughout the state of Oregon, and always welcome those if anybody knows of opportunities that arise there. Passenger transportation users, both on rail and on public transit, rubber tired is important to us. The freight mobility community, I think, is a result of the OTIA efforts and bridges needing to be posted. We have a much greater appreciation now and a much greater working relationship with the trucking associations and what needs to be done to make sure we don't adversely impact that area. Law enforcement is a partner. We couldn't do and could not achieve the rates that we have in terms of reducing deaths and injuries without them. So that's just an example of some of the groups that we work with. The organizational chart that you have on page 21 really just outlines the major divisions of the department. It shows the Transportation Commission on top, again, Stuart Foster, the chair, Gail Achterman, Michael Nelson, Randy Pepe, and Janice Wilson. I think many of you know them. There I am as the director, and you can see that we have the Highway Division, which is Doug Tindall, Central Services, which is Mike Marsh, and they're going to be part of the tag team here in a moment. Troy Costales is the head of the Transportation Safety, Greg Del Ponte in the Motor Carrier Transportation Division, Kelly Taylor, the new administrator for rail, Lorna Youngs in our Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division, Mark Loring on public transit, and Craig Greenleaf on transportation development. And I would point out, off to the right up there on the top, is the Board of Maritime Pilots with Susan Johnson as the administrator of that program. And so if I could, I'd just call your attention to the picture on page 22, and then unless there's other questions, I would ask Mr. Tindall to come up. I think this is a picture I just would point out as a picture of a bridge near Spring, going over the Can-Am? No. McKenzie, thank you. McKenzie River, right at Springfield, where we actually got the governor up in a bucket about 40 feet off the ground to actually view some cracks on a bridge there. So you can't see those very well, but that's what that is. I just want to recognize the governor for getting up in a bucket with us that far off the ground. So I would like to now, if I could, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, turn this over to Doug Kindle, ask him to come up here and go through our programs and services in a very high-level way.
Terrific. Before you sit down, any questions for the director? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith, members of the committee. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation in charge of the Highway Division. I'm going to go through how we are organized to deliver the outcomes that Director Warner has described. I'm not going to get to the level of detail yet to answer Senator Johnson's question or your question, Representative Smith. You got to kind of look at this like peeling an onion, and so we're on the very outer layers, and during phase two there will be the more in-depth discussion of all of those. So with that, I'm going to start with the Highway Division. As you saw in the organization chart, it's the thing that I want to point out to you is that the second bullet on your page, that we only have about 9% of the total road miles in the state, but it carries a little over 60% of the total traffic. So while there are a lot of county roads and Forest Service roads and so forth, we handle most of the traffic within the Highway Division of the Department of Transportation. There's two major areas in the Department of Transportation, and I'm going to just turn quickly over these and save the details for later on, but maintenance and construction are the two primary areas, and listed on pages 24 and 25 are the various aspects of maintenance. There's many activities that are performed to maintain a highway system. And on page 26, the four main activities in construction projects on highway systems, and I call those to your attention because as we get into priorities, you will see these broken out in terms of priorities for each one of our various construction programs. They're really not separable. Preliminary engineering is the design, right-of-way acquisition is acquiring the appropriate property, construction engineering is the oversight for over the contractors and making sure that we're getting what we specified to get, and construction is the actual payment to the contractors.
Question. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Tindall, of the 2,581 employees you have in your division, what is the breakdown between those that are involved in maintenance and those that are involved in construction?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I can get you the exact number. It's around half and half. There's a few more in the construction side than there are on the maintenance side, but I think it's around 1,200 on the maintenance side and 1,300 or 1,400 on the construction side. I can get that for you.
Follow up?
Please.
Would you explain how, if all of the construction is outsourced and much of the design is now outsourced, why would it be that more than half of your staff would be in construction as compared to maintenance, which is kind of an ongoing thing?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, as we've moved to the new structure, we have increased, well, doubled essentially to this point, and as you can see from the chart of jobs, we have radically increased the program that we are overseeing. The people on the construction side now, in addition to doing much less design than they used to do, are overseeing all of those contractors that are doing the design. As a project comes to fruition and gets approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission, it's going to, all of those aspects that are listed on page 26, the preliminary engineering, right-of-way acquisition, we can turn those activities over to a contractor. We still need to be making sure that the contractor is doing the appropriate things with the public's money. It's not, there is an oversight. It's moving from a doing a function to managing a function. And, of course, you can manage with less people than actually doing. And had we kept our typical percentages of design, in-house design, we would have had about, I think we would have had to add about 600 or 700 FTE. So we didn't add any FTE, and instead we switched our engineering expertise over to management expert. Well, they're still engineers, but they're managing more than doing now, I guess is the way I'd summarize that. It is a, there is a, this is a huge amount of work in the program that, I hate to say it that way because you all gave us a lot of money and we're doing a lot of good things, and I don't want to sound like I'm whining. Gosh darn it, that's a tough job. I will get you the more specific numbers on that.
So did those positions require a reclassification?
Representative Smith, as we moved into a decentralized environment, we shuffled a whole bunch of positions around. They are still primarily engineering positions because you still want the engineering expertise as you manage the contract. You want to understand what it is that the consultants and the contractors are showing you. There was some shuffling around as we shuffled the duties around to reorganize, so there was some reclassification, but it wasn't a huge reclassification to a management series.
Thank you. Thank you.
The next two pages detail the various programs in construction, which we will go into as we move through the move through phase two, and a description about what each of those are. Again, it's also a diverse program, as is maintenance has a number of activities, so does construction have a number of different types of projects. So move on in page 29 to the transportation program development arm of the Department of Transportation. There's four major components to this program. This is, they're doing statewide and regional studies and coordinating the federal, state, regional, and local agencies and providing technical assistance to those agencies to design and implement an efficient transportation system for the future. Also included in those in transportation program development or analysis and research, we're required by statute to have a research section, and this is also the area of the department that develops the statewide transportation improvement program, or the STIP, which is that process is ongoing right now as we update it to the 2006-2009 STIP, which will be adopted later this fall. On page 30, we have the face of ODOT, and probably a lot of people think the face of government, much like the post office would be the face of the federal government, DMV is the face of state government. And the DMV touches just almost every Oregonian out there by providing driver's license or identity cards, by titling and registering vehicles, and regulating the sale of vehicles. It's a critical function not only to bring in revenue, but also to promote driver safety and ownership interest in the and for the vehicles traveling on Oregon's roads. On page 31,
really quick, we have a question here, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I know I'm about to take you to a level of detail in DMV that might not be appropriate for right now, and bat me away if this is wrong. There's been a lot of debate in the newspaper about what it takes to get a driver's license in Oregon right now, or an ID card. Are you going to touch on that at some point during your presentation?
Chair Smith, Representative Johnson, I'm not. But in phase two, when we get into the discussion of DMV and those specific sections are covered, the Administrator of Motor Vehicles Division, Lorna Youngs, will be here and can talk about that if she hasn't had a chance to do that on testifying on some of the bills dealing with that that are working its way through the legislature.
That's fine. I just want to know what the status is.
And just for clarification, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, what we'd be referring to is some of the discussion and talking about what the new federal requirements may be in terms of legal presence and in terms of additional requirements in terms of issuing the license versus what we have in Oregon.
ID required, and just what the process is if I were going to walk in right now and get an Oregon driver's license.
Will do.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Real short, road mile. Does that mean a three-lane highway or three-lane freeway would be three road miles within a mile? Or?
Chair Smith, Representative Thatcher, are you talking about when I 8,100 miles?
Yes, you were talking about road miles. I'm just wondering.
8,100 miles are what we call centerline miles, so that's actually a mile that you would think of if you drove from here to Portland. You drive about 50 miles. The other term that we will use just primarily to confuse you, is lane miles, and that is the actual number of centerline miles multiplied by the number of lanes. It's a more accurate way to represent. If you're looking at cost per lane mile, that's more appropriate than cost per road mile, because you can be looking at four or five lanes or two lanes.
All right, thank you.
On page 31, we're on the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. They help truckers comply with Oregon's laws and regulations relating to truck size and weight and safety requirements. This is an arm that is really critical in terms of the long-term life of a transportation system, because the safety of the transportation system, because there are a number of trucks out there, and the structure of size and weight laws has been created to maximize the life, and in fact our designs are based on the laws relating to size and weight. And so they provide that service for us, and they also provide us a critical communication link to one of our biggest customer bases in the trucking industry. Not only biggest, but most critical, as they keep freight moving throughout the state. Next, on page 32, is the Public Transit Division. This division is key for providing mobility so that Oregonians can live independently and participate in Oregon's economy. This division is where we provide choices for all of society, from those people who choose not to drive, to services for the elderly and people with disabilities who may have a problem driving themselves. And they administer grant assistance or grants and advocacy for all of the groups that want to have alternate methods of travel. On page 33,
we have a question really quick, Senator.
I just have one quick question. In your transit division, do you divide your transits in any categories at all? Do you divide them between rural and urban? Do you divide them between whether it's small buses or light rail? Or
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, public transit isn't organizationally, well, it is to some extent organizationally divided along those lines. There are intercity transportation people. It's not a very large division, so I believe there's one person that focuses on intercity transportation. There are people that work on grants to local agencies for buses and those types of things. So divided to that extent, but contained within the public transit division, with the exception of heavy rail passenger service, which I'm going to describe in the rail division. Amtrak, in other words, is not in the public transit division.
A quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Did you say one person handles the grants for the small buses?
I think there might be more than one person that does the grants for the small buses. I was talking about the intercity bus service for intercity coordination. It is not very many people if it is more than one. And the administrator of the Public Transit Division, Martin Loring, will be here in phase two and can describe his organization in far more detail than I can.
All right. Mr. Chair, I'll just reserve my questions for him.
Well, and it's been brought to my attention that under the Public Transit Division tab on page one, it shows the organizational chart.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Did I get it right? I have to. Yes, I did. I got it right. Good for me. Okay, moving on to page 33 in the Rail Division. This is the division that has two functions. It's both advocates for both passenger and freight rail on the system, and also infrastructure safety and rail safety regulation that the department is charged with doing. So it's a regulatory arm in terms of the safety aspect, and an advocacy arm in terms of moving freight by rail and moving people by rail. Page 34 is the Transportation Safety Division. Director Warner mentioned what we call the four E's: education, enforcement, emergency medical services, and engineering. Building a safe transportation system isn't a one-dimensional issue. You can focus on any one of those four E's, and you'll have more or less success, probably less success than if you focus on all four of them. It takes everything working together, really, to build a safe transportation system.
Good question. Representative Richards.
Sure.
I've wondered this for a long time. When there's a crash on the freeway and it damages guardrails, is there a process to assure that the state gets reimbursed from the insurance company for the car that causes that crash so that we don't, the taxpayers don't have to bear that expense?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, yes, there is. That's actually done through the maintenance program, a process where if we can identify a responsible party, we will pursue reimbursement from that responsible party, usually from their insurance company. But that applies to damage to what we call damage to structures, damage to guardrail, things like that. Hazmat cleanups the same way. If somebody spills stuff, we expect, if we do the cleanup, we expect to be reimbursed for our cost.
Can you follow up, please? Could you give me an idea of what percentage of the cost of repair or replacement for guardrails that's caused in motor vehicle collisions gets reimbursed?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I'll have to go back and look that up. It's fairly high. There are not a lot of cases where the cases where they wouldn't be, there's two kinds. One would be where we can't identify a responsible party. Sometimes we'll go out and see guardrail that's been damaged and the car drove away, so we can't track them then. The other one would be an uninsured motorist would be the other case when we can't pursue that. But it's not a big percentage, but I'm not sure where it falls in terms of percentage scale, but I can go find that out.
Thank you.
Can you share with us really quick the coordination that goes on between motor carrier transportation and transportation safety? How do those two work together to ensure that product and people are moving effectively down our highways or other modes of transportation?
And Chair Smith, the Motor Carrier Division is going to be the arm that's going to enforce the safety regulations to make sure that the vehicles that are operated and the people that are driving them are appropriately licensed and appropriately safe. Transportation Safety Division is going to work at a more broad level, not directly associated with the trucking industry. They're going to work on enforcement overall. They don't actually do enforcement, but they're going to look at strategies for enforcement, and safety corridors would be a good example of this, where they will identify a safety corridor and work with the local police departments to patrol that more. Transportation Safety Division has also identified some freight safety corridors where we've had an inordinate amount of trucking-related accidents. And so they're working with motor carrier enforcement to some extent, but largely with the local police department. That's the type of enforcement we're talking about in the Transportation Safety Division. So they work together. They have slightly different ways that they work, one being more vehicle and specific driver licensing, and the other one being the broader structure of how do we enforce, what's our best engineering strategy, how do we best educate that there are concerns in this section of highway.
Well, one of the issues I'd like to raise is in late August, early September, I ended up in my in-district office getting probably five or six phone calls from just irate truckers telling me that they were being stopped off of I-84 on Cabbage for safety inspections. And each and every one of them was carrying a perishable food commodity that was just harvested. And what I'm trying to figure out is, how do we ensure that these trucks aren't being safety inspected one time a year at harvest, but rather we try and get ahead of it the other 11 months out of the year and deal with these issues rather than on the side of an interstate highway?
Representative Smith, I think a good question. I sort of picked that up from earlier that you were sort of asking that question, and we'll have Greg DelPonte, the administrator of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division, describe how they go about selecting the times when vehicles are going to be inspected, both weighed and inspected. I will tell you, though, it's an issue that we understand the sensitive nature of. Certainly not our intention to stop commerce from moving, but probably a delicate balance for us to keep it moving and make sure that it's moving safely.
Well, it just seemed like there needs to be a balance between the safety and the efficiency and try and be proactive and get out front of it, if we can.
Right.
And maybe we can't, I don't know.
Right.
But I think that's an issue we need to address as a state.
All right.
Representative.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's kind of as a follow-up on that, having been intimately involved in that discussion last session. Part of the problem with that is that you're not just checking the vehicle, you're checking the driver of the vehicle, which is what complicates the discussion and trying to get ahead on the inspection.
Perfect. Thank you.
Finally, on page 35, various arms that you see externally, is the Board of Maritime Pilots, as Director Warner mentioned. They're included in our budget process, although not structurally within the ODOT organization. The Board of Maritime Pilots is an independent licensing and regulatory agency for the state maritime pilots on Oregon's rivers.
Senator Johnson.
Have you ever looked at exactly in depth why this makes sense to be in ODOT? Or associated with you?
Chair Smith, Representative Johnson, I have never looked in depth at why that may have occurred. I haven't even looked in a cursory sense at why that may have occurred.
Well, maybe, Mr. Chair, when we get into the second phase, we could have a discussion about why this exists, where it does, how efficacious the work product is, whether or not if this was one of the functions of government that went away, it would be a bad thing.
I'd like to add to that and ask why the ports is not in the Department of Transportation. And so perhaps when we have that conversation, we could piggyback those together.
Sure. It should be a good conversation. As we move forward with Connect Oregon, you'd certainly see some similarities, I think. The last thing I'm going to discuss is the Central Services part of the Department of Transportation. Central Services is essentially where we support all of the other work that the department does. This is all of the accounting services and the personnel and the people who do the computers and communications branch, a really critical portion to make sure that the public's informed, our internal audit processes, and the Office of Civil Rights. That, in a very quick sense, is how we deliver all of the programs that we're charged with, delivering, or maybe more appropriately, how we generate the outcomes that Director Warner talked about in the structure of the department. I will turn it back to Director Warner to talk about our significant budgetary issues.
Actually, I think I was going to have Mr. Marsh come up and talk about those major budgetary issues, but thank you.
Okay.
Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
We were going to transition into the major budgetary issues. I was going to ask Mr. Marsh to go over those.
Before you do that, Mr. Chair, did you want to go through any of the materials that you put in your presentation binders on each of the divisions? Are you
going to
cover any of that material?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Jordan, we were not going to get into that level of detail with this and weren't prepared for that, but if you would like, we can sure go through that. But
why don't we move to the budget issues that you're talking about, and that'll, for the policy side of this committee, that might be worthwhile.
Mr. Chair, Mike Mars from HODOT, Deputy Director for Central Services. Maybe just from the standpoint of history, it'd be helpful for me to briefly mention, as a person who was dealing with the central budget shop of the state in 1993 when the reorganization occurred, I just could just comment briefly that I think the thrust of the governor and the legislature in 93, and people can disagree with me on that, but my recollection was they were trying to group agencies so that we didn't have 120 separate agency functions in state government, and they were just trying to find a place to attach the Board of Maritime Pilots, and felt like the best place to attach was the Department of Transportation, not that it was necessarily the best answer, but that was the best one available, and that's why they made that determination to consolidate it in that kind of way instead of having a freestanding, less than one FTE agency. So with that, unless there's a further follow-up question on that one. I'll go to the major budgetary issues. And, Mr. Chair, looking at the next page of the handout, we're talking about system demands on page 37, which relate to the fact that our system is has a lot of additional pressures on it. The Oregon's population has continued to grow, and we expect 1 million people additional over the next 20 years. The fact is the number of miles traveled in Oregon on roads has grown 27% since 1990, and we have not had a gas tax increase since 1993, and inflation has reduced the buying power of the gas tax by about 1 cent per year. So in looking at the inflation impact, any item purchased for a dollar in 1990 would cost $1.35 now. And looking at the growing transportation needs, the fact is that citizens are expecting more out of the system, and the system as it sits right now is not able to meet those needs. It's also an aging system. Much of the system was constructed before 1960. Like any aging system, there are some problems that we're having to deal with in terms of maintenance and care. We do not want to let the system wear out, because as Mr. Tindall mentioned, when you get to a point on paving where the system is actually starting to fall apart, the cost to go back and restructure that and fix it is much more than if you can maintain it. So that's obviously our goal. There's additional traffic, heavier loads, and new safety standards that are required on the system. And the problem is that if you don't maintain that system, as you know, the system becomes a liability rather than helping economic development. It hinders development and actually is a problem for community livability also. Looking specifically to Bridge, a major issue for us in these last few years in particular, the state's responsible for more than 2,660 bridges. You don't see a lot of them or notice many of them because many of them are quite short, and you go over them before you even realize you've gone over a bridge. But the reality is there are a lot of bridge structures out there, and roughly 25% have been in place for 50 years or more, and they're rapidly reaching their lifespan, and meaning that about 25% are older than me, and I have gray hair, and you can see what's going on here. So obviously I need to do some maintenance as well as these bridges. So the fact is we have to make sure we're doing that maintenance. The first five stages of the aging bridge work is what was funded with OTIA 3. However, that's only one portion of the bridge concern that we're really talking about here. We're talking about additionally a $4.5 billion problem. We're trying to address the first $1.3 billion with what came with OTIA 3. We've got other seismic issues, other issues of the infrastructure, and problems with other bridges that deal with meeting their needs that we have to work on and will become the next step of priority.
I have a question.
Yes.
It came out since we began our session that the funding for these first five phases of OTIA 3 were not on bonds that were approved in OTIA 3 legislation, but were funded by OTIA 1 and 2 funding mechanisms that hadn't been completed. Did I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I don't believe that's correct. Let me restate what I'm hearing you say. OTIAs 1 and 2 did not deal with the bridge issues that OTIA 3 are funding. So they're separate packages, separate projects, and there's not anything that's occurring with OTIAs 1 and 2 that's trying to go to funding and activity in OTIA 3.
Okay, let me ask you a different way. What amount of bonds that were approved in the OTIA 3 legislation have been let?
Okay. OTIA 1 and 2 bonds have been let. OTIA 3, there's not been a formal large bonding yet for the OTIA 3, except for the $300 million bridge program for local governments. We sent that money straight through. So the $300 million was bonded one time to go to local governments.
Okay. So there's been quite an extensive amount of bridge work that's been done under OTIA 3. And am I correct that the funding for that has been through bond measures that were approved prior to OTIA 3.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. I see where you're going. We have done a significant amount of work without bonds on OTIA 3 using the additional revenues that came from the DMV fees. As soon as we get to a point where we feel like the expenditures have got down to an element where we're concerned about the amount of cash the organization has, that's when we will bond. So right now our estimate is August of this year is when we'll go out for the bonding and have additional revenues to work through the projects in OTIA 3.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Members of the committee, I just want to correct one thing that you said. Not all of the money for OTIA 1 and 2 has been bonded yet.
Correct. I don't mean to say it's all been bonded, but all the funds that have been spent from bonds were from ATIA 1 and 2.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, because I thought you said that their bonding for ATIA 3 will begin this year, and if we haven't completed our bonding from ATIA 1 and 2, then obviously we would be completing that before we would move into bonding for ATIA 3. So, you know, what I'm really going to be getting at is there's going to be lots of discussion about Connect Oregon and more money needed for Connect Oregon. And if we are, in fact, funding projects that were presented to the legislature in our last session as being required under OTIA 3 and requiring bonding for OTIA 3 to do, and yet those projects have been completed with bonding authority that was under OTIA 1 and 2, then maybe there will be money available for Connect Oregon without having to grant additional bonding authority.
Mr. Chair and Representative, let me make sure I'm clear. ATIAs 1 and 2 went for projects that were approved as part of ATIA 1 and 2. They did not go for ATIA 3. So although there's been bonding that's been done to address those projects, the funds used for those projects are used on those projects, not for ATIA 3. So ATIA 3 is a separate group of packages. We had a separate commitment with the legislature about what would happen with ATIAs 1 and 2. ATIA 3 is a separate matter. It's not like we crossed those funding sources.
Okay, so all of the bridge work that we have seen from Southern Oregon, we've driven back and forth, you know, every week, those were all projects that were previously on your drawing board, previously approved and previously funded?
Before
last session's discussion about OTIA 3?
Some work has commenced on OTIA 3 projects, but that's being done with cash available from the additional DMV fees.
Okay. As time goes on, we'll probably want to get more detailed information on that.
I take one shot at that before you move on.
Representative Vivakian.
I want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying, too. If you have bonding authority for OTIAs 1 and 2 that you have not used, then are you saying that you don't have the authority to use that bonding for a project under OTIA 3 or any other future projects?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the idea is we've been restricted on how we use the bonds for OTIA 1 and 2 as compared to OTIA 3.
Correct. And then what would happen to that bonding authority if it were just unused?
Off of OTIAs 1 and 2?
Yes.
Right now we're projecting that we'd use that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if for some reason a lot of projects came in under budget and we did not have bond authority, and we had additional revenue, then we would request from the legislature authority to shift those funds. But right now, we aren't seeing that in the forecast.
Senator Virgin.
Yes, and I want to talk about a different pot of money because you're going to probably come in under budget on OTIA 3. So talk about that.
Mr. Chair. You're in charge. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Berger, let me try to answer a clarification on this. For the OTIA 1 and 2 projects, obviously many of those projects are still under construction, and again, payout's going to occur over the next two or three years. We hope the majority of those bonds and those projects will be spent by 2008. There'll be some that'll go on beyond that. So in other words, all of those dollars are committed to those projects, and we expect them to, again, the cash flow to continue on for the next 3 years or so to complete those projects, and we'll sell the OTIA 1 and 2 bonds as needed to fill those projects up as we move forward. There were some bridges on I-5 which were funded by OTIA 1 and OTIA 2. There was also a couple bridges that we actually had underway as a result of our ability to move cash flow and see some economies of scale by essentially building the bridge right beside the one that was built under OTIA 1 that also part of OTIA 3. So we will come back to you. You will see the overall funding, and we need all $1.3 billion, we think, now. What Senator Berger is asking is, if you look at the work that's been done with the Oregon State University, we are reevaluating every bridge that we're doing to determine, do we need to replace it, or now with this additional information, can we look at a replacement, which may not be a significant reduction, but there are some reductions in the cost of replacing all those bridges that we told you we would replace. So when we get to the point where we feel comfortable that those monies are actually savings, And I'm ready to tell you that we have enough experience under our belt in terms of the of those projects being done and not having something like the escalation of steel prices cause a big bump in the construction cost. Then we could talk about coming back to you about how would we use any savings from that program. And I think what we told your committee, Senator Berger, is about 2 years from now, as we've got about another $500 million worth of projects out the door, we'll have a pretty good idea of where we sit on completing the projects.
But you can't really shift those funds at all. Those come from license and they go into the highway fund.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, those monies, the legislative intent was quite clear that they were, those were to be used for these specific five stages of the bridges. So if again, there's money left over from that, we would need to come back to you to get some authorization to spend it on something else. The second question is, could you use it on something...
Or give it back to the taxpayers with the reduction of fees or something?
You could do that. Yes, you could.
That's correct.
But what I wanted to point out in relation to the other question is that those funds could not be utilized for the projects that we envision under Connect Oregon because they are bound by the Constitution to be used on highways and roads and bridges.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Can you clarify then, because when we did OTA 3, we knew there was approximately a $4.5 billion backlog of repairs for bridges, of which we did 1.3. So if we were saving money on this, do you have to come back to us to get authority to do more repairs on bridges that we need or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I'm not the attorney here in terms of the budget law, but all I know is that we made a commitment to do stages 1 through 5 with the $1.3 billion. I would think that if we're able to do more than that, than what's identified in stages 1 through 5, we would want to have a discussion with you before we moved ahead and put it anyplace else. And whether we needed to change the law or at least seek a nod from the legislature, I would want to do either of those.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, then moving on to page 40 of your handout goes into the major budgetary issues for rail and transit. Did want to mention that we do have improved transportation links that have dramatically helped Oregonians in this area. We still, however, do not have a dedicated fund source that really funds the majority of the needs in these areas. So currently there's general fund that does go for rail for the Willamette Valley passenger rail program. And then we have the intercity passenger rail and bus service that allows for the buses to fill in the gaps where we cannot make timely connections using the train system. So that significantly helped citizens use this alternative to using the highway and also reduce the demand on our highways.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I might add also when we get into looking at this particular program area, I'm sure the issue of the President's budget and his recommended reduction in funding for Amtrak will be of concern, and so we will try to ascertain exactly what that new budget means for Oregon if we can, so we can answer your questions regarding how that might affect the rail service in the I-5 corridor.
Moving on, Mr. Chair, to page 41 discusses revenues. A major concern for us is looking ahead to the future and figuring out what will happen to the highway fund. And looking at the fuel efficiency of modern vehicles as well as hybrids that are coming up with alternatives for different fuels, the fact is there's going to be a declining revenue source that is occurring regarding the highway fund. So the session in 2001 created the Road User Fee Task Force to look at alternatives for that. I think the members are aware. And those alternatives have been evaluated, and there will be a pilot project coming forward with volunteers to identify some of the challenges as well as the opportunities that would exist with alternative systems using technology that allows us to track vehicle use. And as we expect right now and looking towards the future, different economic analyses have been completed, but between 7 and 14% of the market is expected to be hybrid and other highly fuel-efficient vehicles within the next 10 years. So that's a big change for Oregon as well as a big change nationally. The Federal Highway Administration and the U.S. Department of Transportation are very interested in what we're going to find with this pilot and may find that it'll be helpful for the rest of the country. We're, in essence, leading that effort. Moving on, we've talked briefly about OTIA, the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, but just to make sure things are clear there, Atiyah's 1 and 2 from the 01 session and the special session in 02, allowed for a $500 million program, $400 in Atiyah 1 and then another $100 million in Atiyah 2, which was focused on 173 projects around the state. No additional staff was added during that time frame. And then on page 43 goes into Atiyah 3, where we talk about the successes of building on the first two phases of Atiyah, and that the 03 session addressed the aging bridge concern as well as other elements through Atiyah 3. And so we're using additional revenues coming from the driver and motor vehicle fees for a total of almost $2.5 billion. And the details on that are on page 44, where it lists out what the funding initiative included. I'll just briefly touch on a few of those. As we mentioned earlier, $1.3 billion of bonds to repair and replace 365 state bridges. I mentioned the $300 million in bonds for the local bridges that went directly to them in one package, so that all that money resides now with the local governments, and they have the ability to go out and address those problems. We have the city and county maintenance, which is not bond-funded, but is part of the new revenue. And then the $500 million for modernization, again, not new revenue, but that's what will be spent by ODOT moving forward, along with the federal advanced construction money.
Just so I'm clear and the committee's clear, on Atiyah 3, how many of those projects have begun?
Mr. Chair, I'm hearing an estimate of 40, but we will get back to you and confirm that.
Let me ask a follow-up on that. Of those 40, how much of that is from the bond sales? Where did the money come from for those 40
projects? Mr. Chair, those Atiyah 3 expenditures would come from the revenues that are received due to the increased fees. Once we get to a point where we've spent down on the increased fees, we will bond, and we're expecting that to be in August. So for Atiyah 3, these expenditures would be on the basis of increased fees, not bonds.
I think you folks do good work, but I think it's a little disingenuous for us as elected leaders and for other elected officials to be going around the state talking about the new construction projects as a result of Atiyah 3 when those Atiyah 3 bonds haven't been utilized.
Mr. Chair, let me give that a shot. I think as your financial managers on the subject, you're asking us to make sure that we go out and bond when it makes sense. We do have to pay interest on bonds. So like any other financial management institution, I don't think you want us incurring the debt of bonds if we have the revenues available at this time and can make the expenditures for the initial engineering work and the very beginnings of work on the actual projects and construction themselves. As soon as we spent that down and are at a point where we are concerned about the cash flow, then we want to go out and get the money through the markets. But this way, we're not incurring interest. Although interest is relatively low, it is something that is going to be an additional cost to us, and we can get more done for the people of Oregon if we use the revenues coming in as efficiently as we can before we actually bond.
So on those existing dollars that you had for the 40 projects, how long have you had those existing dollars? Is that ending balance?
Mr. Chair, what we're talking about is the additional revenues that commenced upon the effective date of the Atiyah 3 legislation. So those fee increases that commenced after the 03 session. And I'm thinking back, some of the bill was effective in October, some I believe in January. So it would be January of 04 would be the starting point for those fee increases.
Got it. Thank you very much. That's really helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at those, the detail then that completes the Atiyah 3 element. Brief discussion then on the economic variables. And, Mr. Chair, we've talked about rates out there as it relates to the bond markets. One of the reasons the rates have been low is because of the recession nationwide. That's getting better. Rates have been fluctuating, going up and back down, and are going back up again, we're expecting shortly. But the bottom line for us is that we still have to get the jobs out there. So a big component of us doing this work is addressing the bridges and modernization concerns, but also to get jobs commenced. And so we're pushing very hard on getting the money out and having the contractors commence that work. And that's why we're doing the majority of our work through outside contractors instead of through design professionals at ODOT. So we're getting the job growth. We'll talk more about that specifically as we get into the performance measures later on in the discussion, probably tomorrow. The transportation revenue declines when the employment declines, and that's one of the problems on our revenue source here, too. However, as things have started to come back, there have not been all that many jobs that have returned, but some have returned, and as that occurs, our revenues have been stabilizing. So in terms of what may be your concerns about our revenue forecast and how things look, we're anticipating about 1.5% revenue increase. So we're anticipating that things will be moving up and that we will be able to handle most of what occurs in terms of inflation over this next year with the additional revenues that we're expecting. The problem is looking backwards at what's occurred up to this point in terms of inflation. So, Mr. Chair, I'm open to questions about these points or others on the overview to date.
Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Smith. I want to be sure. I think I heard that the $300 million in bonds that went to replace 141 local bridges, that has already been bonded. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, we bonded that money, yes.
Okay, so that those were sold of a OTIA
yes.
3 bonds.
And it went to the local governments, not for the state.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Any questions? Is there a, or can you share with us the internal strategy on how you determine when is the appropriate time to sell the bonds?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do that. And as soon as I see people's heads start to go back like this, I'll know I've gone into too much detail. I've already done it. Mr. Chair, we try to draw, identify what would be the same as your own checkbook and determine what is a minimum cash balance that you'd want to have. And that is done by analyzing what your average monthly expenditures are and identifying how much expenditure could there be in a month and how much time does it take us to commence a bond process, issue the bonds, and have the revenues come back. So we look at about a 60-day process maximum from the time we would say, ooh, we got a bond, until we got to have that money in the coffers. So then we look at the minimum cash balance, and we figure approximately $100 million is our minimum. And that means we have to be able to cover those expenditures of what we might expect from projects and other regular expenditures that the organization would have in a period until we can get the bonds back. So as a quick answer, if that's satisfactory, Mr. Chair, that's how we identify it.
One other quick question on that. One component of the project was city and county maintenance and preservation dollars. Are they still waiting to receive their portion of this money?
Mr. Chair, no. When we're looking at those monies, those are fees that come in and go directly to cities and counties as part of the, what we call the highway fund, which is 60% state and 40%.
Okay, these are highway fund county. Dollars.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I didn't want to leave out an element to your question. If you wanted me to follow up on that minimum cash balance piece, I left out a lot of complexity that relates to a need for us to deal with other reserves out there, everything from the fact that when the legislature completes here, we will have an approved budget, but we will not probably have an agreement with the labor unions. And that means that we must be able to go in and use some of that ending cash balance for whatever is agreed to. So each session, the Legislative Assembly approves our budget, but usually does not approve any incremental increase for collective bargaining. So we would come back and we would identify some ending balance that would go for that purpose. And then when collective bargaining is completed, we come back to the Emergency Board, and the Emergency Board allows for expenditure limitation to do that. That's one idea or example of the kinds of things we must plan for that are not part of the regular expenditures of the budget and are part of the reserves that the ending balance has to handle.
I appreciate your answer. I appreciate the candidness that clears it up. Any other questions?
Okay. Would you like me to keep moving into the accountabilities piece of the this is on page 46 of our materials, and there's a lot in each one of these accountabilities, but I think it is important to note that we, like every other public agency, does have required outside audits, both from a financial standpoint, and obviously the Secretary of State looks at things from a performance standpoint for all of our programs. And then we, like many other large departments, have our own internal audit function, where essentially we are always assessing areas of risk and trying to get ahead of those risks to make sure that we understand what's going on and can take actions to minimize risks. And again, this is from everything from cash handling at our DMV offices to how we pay cities and counties under our federal aid projects, as an example. And we have some very, very good reports from our internal audit folks that help us do business better. And I think you'll notice down there in the middle of the page is the internal audit committee. And I want to acknowledge the hard work of a number of my executive staff. And Commissioner Randy Pape was on this internal audit group until just a few months ago. And now Commissioner Gail Ackerman is sitting on that group, where essentially we take a hard look at the business practices, the checks and balances in all of our programs where we think they're a risk, to try to do things better. But obviously we do work with the outside agencies and Secretary of State on audits. The program budget...
May I just ask clarification? Is this just financial audits? Do you have any performance audits?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, the financial audits are done by the accounting firms for the state for us. The performance audits are done by the Secretary of State and our internal audit. That's what they're really looking at doing, is trying to do things better, not specifically looking at the dollars and cents and making sure they add up, if I'm answering your question.
Okay. Thank you.
The other thing that we prepare on a biennial basis is what we call a program budget. And essentially, thank you very much. This is an example of that, and if you've seen this, this is something that we try to put together so that you don't have to wander and wade through all of that three-ring binder you have on a regular basis to get an answer. This provides, again, the programs, the summaries of the budget. This is where we put the bubble chart that I think you've seen, so you know where the money comes from and goes to in the department, in an attempt to simplify ODOT's budget. And this is something I think most people find very, very helpful in terms of understanding what we do and how we're being accountable with the monies. The other thing that I wanted to note is that in terms of project communication, my mantra to the staff is early and ongoing involvement. And one of the things that I think we have gotten in trouble on in the past is when we start working on a project, we work with the community to determine what the solution is, and then go away for a couple of years while we're designing it, come back, and gosh, there's a whole bunch of new folks elected on the city council or the planning commission, and they don't like the project, or frankly, the project had changed from when they originally saw it. And so one of the things we're trying to do is make sure that we have early and ongoing involvement with the communities out there, so that any changes or any mid-course corrections that need to be made are done on a real-time basis involving the communities. And I think that's one thing that has aided us a lot in moving projects forward more quickly, because you can imagine if you get to a project 2 years out, somebody says they don't like the design, all of a sudden you got to stop and figure out where to go from there. But if you've had those discussions all along, you can keep the project moving on track. Another thing which has been very, very helful for us was first a committee that was established by the previous director, Grace Krenikin, and then the committee was put into statute to advise the governor and the department on freight issues, was our Freight Advisory Committee. And this is a group that really helps make sure that we, as we move forward and select projects, that they are important for freight movement throughout the state of Oregon. And that's a committee we think will have an increasing role if Connect Oregon becomes a reality. It's one that we think that they will be one of the committees we want to utilize to make sure that we are matching up the shippers with the right types of transportation and the transportation investments we need to make. The STIP Stakeholder Committee, the State Transportation Improvement Program Stakeholder Committee, was something that we worked on. Our chair, Stuart Foster, actually spent 2 years of his life working with committee members for once a month, I believe it was, for about 2 years, and essentially helping us define and work to come up with better criteria and procedures of which to actually value projects and make sure that they're ready to go into the state transportation improvement program for construction. Because sometimes, as you know, we will pick a project that maybe hasn't gone all through all of the local required hoops and isn't ready to go, so we end up spending a lot of time and effort doing some of the legwork that should have been done earlier. So we've set up standards, and I think as a result of that, our state transportation improvement program is now something you can look at as legislators engineers and understand the projects in there are real, and we anticipate to have those done on or near the date that's identified in that plan. And then another thing that's been very important, I think, for us and for all of Oregon is the commission did charter area commissions on transportation throughout the state, where essentially we gather together local elected officials and business members of the communities to advise us on transportation priorities and issues in their area, not just highway, although that's what they've been focusing the majority of their effort on in the last few years. But this group, what we found out is the understanding and data sharing between local governments and ourselves in terms of just understanding each other's budgets and where the priorities are and where, as Representative Gilman knows, opportunities are for us to partner up have been just invaluable for the department. And I want to salute the members of those committees because they do a great deal of work for free for the department in terms of making our lives easier and also, I think, getting the right investments for Oregon. The other thing you may not be aware of is we do have a citizens representative program, essentially an ombudsman in the department. When people, we have a hotline that people can call, and we strive to be very, very responsive to citizens and get back to them with issues. And then I think the other thing we do in terms of accountability, if you go on our ODOT website, you can get the things like Trip Check, but you can also find the State Transportation Improvement Program online. You can find the schedules. You can find the guidelines and criteria for project selection. You know where public hearings are, and you have real time or as quickly as we can get them, minutes and agendas of our various meetings of advisory committees. So we're trying to use all of these kind of tools to, again, assure accountability and transparency in all of the work we do at the Department of Transportation. Doesn't mean we can't do it better, but we really are trying to do better at the way we get our information out to the citizens. So that's just a snapshot of some of the things we're doing there.
Senator.
I would just add at this point that much of my district is served by Region 1 and Region 2, and I can't recall a time that I have called and not gotten a call immediately back. I think you are inculcating in your region managers a customer service ethic that fits in with this accountability that I appreciate. It's not always the answer I want to hear, but I got the phone call, and that matters.
Well, I would add to that, Senator. I think the only region that's probably better than yours is mine, and they're absolutely exceptional in responding. And I would concur with you. It may not be the answer I always want to hear, but it's always professional, and it's responsive in a timely manner.
Thank you. That's what I want to hear. May I turn on Mike, and he can cover the last piece of this part of this phase one.
Mr. Chair, we've moved to the last page of this handout. It's page number 47, called the high-level budget, and I think the idea here was to just give a context to the overall budget so that members had an idea of the magnitude of numbers we're talking about and the context of how those interplay with each other. This is the overall Department of Transportation budget. As you can see, it begins with the Highway Division at the top there with the essential budget level and the 0507 budget, with some policy packages in the middle column and the governor's recommended budget on the right. What we have for policy packages this time are focused on those things that are legal requirements. Those are elements that, in essence, must be done kind of requirements for the department. We're not requesting permanent positions. We're requesting, where we have to, some limited duration positions, which we'll talk about later. In terms of the size of the budget, if you look at the Highway Division, the two primary components are construction and maintenance, and approximately $1.7 billion is the amount that's shown for construction, and about $299 million for the maintenance component, remembering that the vast majority of the construction component is contracted out. Significant portion of the maintenance are done by employees, about 80% done by employees. Looking at driver and motor vehicle services, we say DMV. It's not Department of Motor Vehicles. It's a division of the Department of Transportation. And its budget is shown there at $128 million. With, again, some requirements relating to a question from Senator Johnson earlier, we have several additional requirements from the federal government that deal with things like hazardous material, identification issues, and pending even as we speak. By the time we end up in phase two, maybe we'll have some answers from the federal government about their expectations as it deals with identification. But as of yesterday, there's still debate and voting and a long ways to go before we know exactly what their expectations will be. Realistically, I'd expect that we'll get agreement about what the state legislature would like to see, and then probably have to come back to the emergency board for discussion about exactly what the federal requirements did. Looking at Motor Carrier Transportation Division, one of our major elements there is making sure we're operating efficiently, and that means using information systems as best we can. So we'll discuss with you some elements of our Green Light program, which is the program that allows trucks to move through without stopping at weigh stations. We think it's a very effective program, and has been, in essence, a trendsetter for other states. We just need to do some work to make sure we continue it that way. Transportation Safety Division, we'll talk quite a bit tomorrow in the performance measurement discussion about transportation safety and all the different types of measures we use both internally and with the federal government to be able to compare ourselves to other states and to make sure that for you and citizens we're doing a good job of getting those four E's completed and reducing fatalities and accidents. The amount of money there is not showing much change, and that's due to the pretty flat degree of federal funds that are coming in, as well as our state funds. For the rail division, we're showing some shifts there, and that relates to the continuation of the Willamette Valley Passenger Rail. On transportation program development, that's where we do the planning and set things in motion for the future so that we can have projects coming down the pike. We'll talk about the changes that occurred there, and some of that change in dollar amounts do relate to organizational shifts in the department. Board of Maritime, or Central Services next. That's our central function of supporting the divisions and getting the work done, as Doug mentioned earlier. We're looking at some moderate increases there that relate to construction and getting contracts out the door. So we'll have some limited duration work to make sure those contracts are timely and we do get those projects done or started on time. The Board of Maritime Pilots is pretty flat. We'll talk with them in terms of the budget amounts. The revenues coming in from the board are an issue right now. We'll talk briefly with you about some decisions made by the board about whether to make some reductions or to seek some fee increases that relate to continuation of board activity. Lottery debt service is just maintaining the debt service for the bonding that we've have already started, and then it will relate to also the next steps as we continue to do more bonding in 05-07, making sure we have the debt service address to make those payments. Capital improvement and construction. Capital improvement are those projects that are small and relate to fixing roofs or replacing roofs, but the major component of capital construction in this case relates to building out a couple maintenance stations that were started last session or in the current interim. And then also looking at changes at the transportation building as we commence work to make an update in the transportation building similar to what has occurred on the other buildings on the Capitol Mall. And non-limited programs, I won't take time to bore the members about non-limited, but I think the members are aware of what the concept is, simply that rather than having an internal service fund show two expenditure limitations, both for the paying service receiver as well as the service provider. There have been non-limited programs so that that internal services provided, such as graphics work or photography or other services that might be done as part of a project, are shown as non-limited. As I understand it, for the future, we may be reducing the amount of non-limited or even totally eliminating non-limited. We'll talk about that as we go through the discussion of the budget in detail.
Perfect. We're going to go to Senator Johnson and then Representative Burley.
No question.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you please explain again what the column policy packages is?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, of course. Policy packages are those elements that are beyond the current service level budget or beyond the base budget of the agency, and where we're coming in to request a package to say for this purpose we're requesting additional expenditure limitation to accomplish this function.
So it could be new policies being proposed, debated in this building. It could be federal mandates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, it's actually a package of expenditure that we're seeking authority from you to spend money to address a certain issue. The word policy package has been used this session in the past. Have been called decision packages or additional budget or all sorts of different words for it, but it is a confined package that says for X amount of dollars, here's what we expect to do. The governor has recommended it forward. Sometimes it can relate to a new policy decision. Sometimes it can be just simply a workload issue saying that additional work's coming in and we're seeking approval to move ahead and address this concern.
Would you like a follow-up?
Please. Thank you. So just to help me understand, for example, the Motor Carrier Transportation Division policy package is a reduction of $1.7 million.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, what these amounts mean is that at times we'll come in and actually request a shift of funds. And so it may be that under one line it'll show as a increase, and another place it'll show as a decrease. Other times it's an increase and showing just an additional requirement of funds. I don't know if the chair wants me to go into some of the packages at this point, but just to maybe to make it more tangible, for instance, a package for us, one of them is dealing with hazardous materials issues with DMV. So the fact is we have a requirement from the federal government saying we have to do a certain kind of a program in order to deal with hazardous materials. That requires an increased fee. That means that we are coming into the legislature to say we'd like to have that fee approved and also have expenditure limitation to address the program. We've done that, and that's what would come forward to you. So I think the representative is right. It's, in essence, a policy decision on your part many times, but sometimes it's a little more of just a workload kind of issue.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Representative Richardson.
Just a quick comment that, you know, having been reviewing the Department of Human Services budgets and the education budgets, it's a unique approach to see full current service level requests plus new programs, which is really what we're talking about with policy packages, new expenditures for additional amounts. It must be unique and wonderful to have your own source of funding.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I should respond, but I think the bottom line is the legislature invested an increased program for us out of the 03 session in expectation of building jobs and fixing a bridge problem, and so that's why we're back to address that.
Representative Hunt.
Following up, I'm having some of the same struggle that Representative Burley is having. Can I just pick an example, and maybe your description will help me understand. If you look under the rail division sheets, the very last page, which I think is the only place within each section, the policy option packages are always listed at the end of each section. Is that correct? I'm sorry. I'm looking at the book.
This one here. Yes.
So the book you've got on the rail division.
Okay.
Tab on page 19 and 20.
Yes.
I see. Looks like four policy option packages, which, as I'm looking at them, add up to about $5.4 million. But then I look over on your summary page on the PowerPoint, and it has the policy packages at $7.9 million. What am I missing?
I'll miss up, Chair. Mr. Chair, in responding to the question about policy packages, what you're looking at here on page 19 and 20 is an individual listing of the policy packages. So you've got the $5 million of general that deals with general fund, and then the other packages which detail out the amount that would go in other funds for other fund sources. So you have two different elements there. And then there's the element that we are making a shift in the current program. Our host staff can jump in if you wish. But we've shifted from the funding source of how we've dealt with the rail program this year. And we had a one-time funding source that allowed us to use what's called Environmental Quality Information Fund, which was a fund source that was available one time that had an ending balance that allowed us to make a shift of funds from that source to reduce the general fund needed for rail just for the 03-05 period. Now we're coming back in 05-07 and having to shift back because the monies were not available. So what this says here is that we have to add, in order to maintain the current service level, we've got $5 million of additional need that has to be restored from the general fund, and that's why that amount has gone up. And your question also relates to why the $7.9 million that's on the sheet. I'm trying to think of, I believe it would be one of the essential packages, if I'm not mistaken, that dealt with the...
And Mr. Chair, what in this particular, phase two is when we were really going to get into discussing the dollars, but in this particular program, they phased out the Lewis and Clark excursion train, which had been funded for three years. And so that shows a large reduction, and then it nets out at the end to a while they're adding packages, it also netted with that reduction to a 7.8 million, right. 9 million reduction overall.
And I'd point out, colleagues, the discussion we're having right now will be more of a phase two discussion because we've gone through our entire agenda and we still have a few minutes left. We're allowing these type of questions to proceed forward. What I would share with the whole group is for this Ways and Means Subcommittee, the Department of Transportation will be the most complicated budget that we review and go through. And one of the things we've shared with our committee is that we're going to be setting up special times to sit down aside from the committee, being careful of quorum issues, gotta say that, to allow members to come in and just ask individual questions and to walk through some of these things at a very detailed level. We'll be getting word out, if that's okay, Chair. So anyone who has a question on a particular policy package issue can work through it with the department and with LFO directly. So. I have a question. Back on the citizen representative program, mm-hmm. How do you folks get the word out to the citizenry that's available to them? Or do we not want to?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't know of all the venues that we do that, but I believe it's clearly posted on our website and it's clearly in the phone book. Other than that, those are about the only two that I could talk off the top of my head about.
Would it be possible to get members on this committee at a minimum just... yep, cards or brochures or anything of that nature, because I find so often when constituents call us, if they just had a person they knew that could serve as an advocate for them, it'd be easy for us to refer them and to know that they do have someone who's looking into the issue for them.
We'll be glad to do that, Mr. Chair. I just noticed that the phone number is pretty simple. People remember it's 888-ASK-ODOT.
Oh.
But again, I think you can also go on TripCheck, and you can go on our ODOT website and the state website to get through that. But I'll check and make sure we get you all the venues where that is, and I'll see if what you're saying is maybe you'd like to have some cards or brochures that could hand out in the department if people had questions.
It's easier than having to call you folks. And, yep. If we could just pass those cards out. And, any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I do. Representative.
And I'm not sure if this is the day for it, but does the Department of Administrative Services perform any functions on behalf of ODOT? And if so, what?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. I can talk as long as you'd like on that subject. They obviously represent us in collective bargaining. We have people at the table, but they are the lead people at that table. They review our classifications for personnel purposes. When we do bonding, they actually represent us in the bonding process along with the state treasurer's office. In terms of finance, the payroll checks that come out through the Oregon State payroll system, so DAS does that for us. I'm probably the wrong one to answer these questions because I worked for DAS for 20 years myself, but I could go on for quite a while on this subject, but they do provide services that we as an agency use.
Would you like a follow-up?
Yes. I just saw that there was a central services, and I just wondered if there's any overlap there.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this is one of those issues of determining what that central agency can do. If the decision of the legislature was that everything would be centralized into the Department of Administrative Services, we would ship people who reside in our agencies that do human resources, financial work, all the other components of what is, in essence, the implementation of work. They do the policy work at the Department of Administrative Services and make the policy decisions and then review us, post-audit our work to determine, are we classifying things right? Are we paying bills timely? Are we doing other things? And if they find an agency that is not doing those things appropriately, they either pull it back centrally into the Department of Administrative Services or deal with some other way to shift that agency so they can perform as the legislature expects.
Please, well, one more unrelated question, actually.
Yep, we've got time.
Have you ever thought of, I'm sure it may have been approached before, maintenance construction? Some of it gets let for contracts for regular contracting companies to perform, And I'm just wondering why more of them aren't let for bid. It seems like great opportunities for minority women and emerging small businesses.
Sure. I'd give that a shot, but I hear a guy back here wanting to comment. <for all that.
laughs> Chair Smith, Representative Thatcher, Doug Tindall again in my old role. We do contract out a lot of maintenance work, and the legislature in a redistributions of funds last year gave us $16 million. We contracted all of that $16 million out. Additionally, we have some strategies to do some increase our emerging small business participation, and we're trying to get into other types of contracts rather than just horizontal construction, but actual buildings and some of our facilities maintenance, some of our rest areas, those types of things. We've tried in the last two winters to contract out some snow removal and have not gotten bidders to do that for us. So we continue to look for opportunities to contract out that work. And we will continue to look for opportunities to contract out that work and try and expand that.
Hello. Senator Berger.
Yes, I want two things. I would like to comment on the contracting out. I'm really only interested in Argonians working, so I don't want Florida companies coming to North Bend to paint the bridge. The other thing that I missed in your handout is some work that you do that maybe you touched on and I missed it, but it's the work that you do with Washington State and with other adjoining states that you work quite well in many ways, and I wondered if that's not if you're not remiss in not mentioning that.
Chair Smith, Senator Berger, sorry. Okay, that's the last session.
I worked hard to get that title. Do you?
We do a number of things with our, as you point out, our neighboring states. That work is contained within one of those programs, usually in the maintenance program. There's a little bit of work in the construction program with some intelligent transportation systems in the southern, south central Oregon area that we did with California. We coordinate with those, with the states that the bridges over the Columbia, for instance, each bridge has its own agreement, and one state or the other says they're going to do the work. The other state basically pays half of the money. So we have those kinds of agreements. We also have agreements with the other states for emergency services so that we can provide emergency services if we need them, or we can provide them to other states if they need them. But the in the southern Oregon area, maybe the critical one near Representative Gilman's district, is not in a cost-sharing sense so much, although we cross over the state line a little bit in snow removal, but as you cross over the Siskiyou Mountains on Interstate 5, it's really critical to coordinate closely with Caltrans, because it doesn't do us any good to have our road open if their road's closed or vice versa. And so we have worked diligently to try, and that we did have that situation happening sometimes, and we have worked diligently to become much closer with our partners at Caltrans to make sure that we have a commensurate level of service on both sides. That's not actually a cost-sharing one. Wouldn't show up in a budget, but it is a coordination effort.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to be sure, because I think that they deserve kudos for the work that they do with their neighboring states.
Let me ask a question. If I was a minority small business owner wanting to do business with the Department of Transportation, how would I go about doing that?
Well, Representative Smith, there's probably a couple of ways you can do that. Our civil rights organization does some outreach to try and let people know that those projects are out there. We've done... In terms of our contracting process, as I mentioned, there's a specific set aside in state law for emerging small businesses, and so the civil rights section recruits, and actually they do it with the help of our all of our offices across the state. We recruit organizations that fall into that category, and then there are bids that go out that are specifically sent to those businesses because they're the ones that are, in fact, only ones that can get those particular projects.
You mentioned recruitment. How does that work?
If I'm a district manager in LeGrand, I'm going to know who's around and what businesses are coming up just because I see them out, I see their trucks out there, and it'll be a conversation to, it could be in a regular a forum that we go out and do, or it could be just talking to them and saying, hey, how big are you? Do you qualify for this program? You may want to get signed up, and here's the guy to call to get signed up for the program.
Have you ever, has the department ever worked with the Small Business Development Center to let them know about this program?
Turn that back to Mike. I believe so, but I'll let Mike.
Mr. Chair, yes, with the Economic Development Department, and yes, we've had contacts with them, as well as combined with the Department of Administrative Services and the Governor's Advocate on Minority Women and Emerging Small Business to co-sponsor some conferences. And this last year, we've had about three where they've been communicating about availability of emerging small business and also trying to get some feedback about ideas as it relates to how to get folks built up to the OTO3 demand that we're going to have out there for contractors. And so right now we're in the midst of trying to especially get to women, young people who could maybe start looking at the trades, as well as dealing with workforce issues and contractors themselves to try to get this information out. So we've been out doing quite a few different kinds of fairs and other mechanisms to try to get the information out, but we could give you more detail if you like.
What I would share with this committee is since we've begun, I've been advocating that the state of Oregon needs to be small business friendly and almost to the point of being annoying, and I acknowledge that, but I'm going to continue on that beat, because I want our small business owners to be able to access opportunities within the state of Oregon, and I want to make sure that every Oregonian, no matter what, no matter what their skin color, no matter what their gender, no matter what their state of life is, has an opportunity, at least an opportunity, to do business with the state of Oregon. And I'll keep beating that drum no matter how annoying it gets, I guess, until they take the gavel away. So, yeah, Senator Carter.
I, 5 years ago, I couldn't say what I'm saying today. But I have to tell you, this department is a model for all of the departments, all of the agencies in our state. The Department of Transportation has worked very hard and very long at looking at this issue, and we didn't have to beat them over the head. We did need to give them some time to look at how they can get the job done. And they have worked to that end, and they have now become the enemy of some of their past partners, which I find very interesting and very good, because they shouldn't have been sleeping in the bed in the first damn place. And so I'm very happy to support the Department of Transportation and the direction in which they're going for minority and women in businesses. And they're going to even do more, Mr. Chairman, and you and I are going to have a conversation about that.
Terrific. Terrific. Is there any other questions or comments of the committee? Well, we're on schedule. Truly appreciate the good, positive tone, Director Warner, you set for us. And we look forward to tomorrow. And if any of you have any additional questions, I'm sure Director Warner would be more than willing to address them with you one-on-one. With that said, we're going to close this public hearing. Thank you. That's all.